Welcome back to Verivox. This is installment two of our interview with Simon Templar, being introduced by Rainbows Since You've Been Gone. You all have noticed that last time we opened with Steeler's Wheel and their classic and all too appropriate Stuck in the Middle with You. Those have been substitutes for our usual Try a Little Kindness by the venerable Glen Campbell. But let's jump right into our second episode of our conversation with Simon. Last time we spent a good long while on some background and some of the earlier stages of how things unfolded at Aetna. Tonight we're going to continue with the special meeting of classes that happened at the very tail end of 2015, so just a little over 3 years ago. So Simon, thanks again for being with us.
You're welcome.
For taking the time to both prepare and chat.
Sure. Yeah. I hope this is constructive and beneficial for those who hear it. Not only that it helps us to process and sort some things out, but also that people who hear it might get some insight into how these situations go. And we always have the hope, too, that it might prevent people from handle these things in a less appropriate way. So
right.
Or an inappropriate way.
Right. Mm-hmm. We'll pray it's constructive, as you say, and productive.
Yeah.
Right. Well, let's open with this. Think about your D-Day, as we called it back then and still call it now. This was the special meeting of classes on the 8th of December, 3 years ago. When you reflect on that night, what stands out to you and why?
Well, a few things stand out. Just the atmosphere and the gathering itself. It was almost like a spectacle because there were so many people from Aetna Church that came to watch the proceedings.
Mm-hmm.
And I probably had on my side of the sanctuary. It took place at a church that's only 3 miles away from where we met at Aetna. And on my side of that sanctuary, there were probably 15 or 20 people, mostly from the church. There were a few that didn't attend our church, but who knew people or knew me personally, who came to support me. And then there were a number of people who were, I guess, curious about what was going on. Some of them were definitely not on my side, but they came as well to watch the proceedings.
Mm-hmm.
So that was odd. The atmosphere was noticeably chaotic. The people leading the meeting didn't seem to know how to proceed. So there was like an aura of confusion. I picked up on it, and a couple of other people who were there said the same thing, that it just seemed chaotic and there seemed to be confusion. The synodical deputies, whenever you have an Article 17 and a classis is going to vote on whether to approve it, synodical deputies have to be present. Those are representatives of the denomination, but they have to be present to make sure that the proper protocol is followed.
Mm-hmm.
The synodical deputies were late. I don't remember if it was really snowy that night. It was early December, but they were late. They were about a half hour or more late getting to the meeting. And so a communication came from them after the meeting started as to where they were and to how late they were going to be.
Mm-hmm.
So they had to change the order of the meeting. And they dealt with a procedural matter that didn't require the synodical deputies. And then at about a half hour or 40 minutes after the meeting started, they began to get into the Article 17 matter. So that really stood out. And then they asked for any input from the delegates who were there. And one of the elders from Aetna, who had actually presided over my suspension and subsequent termination, he stood up and in a very roundabout way disavowed what they did. He expressed his discomfort with the proceedings and was very noticeably uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And said that he wished there were another way or another process that churches could go through if they felt like it was time for a minister to move on, something to that effect.
I remember
but
that.
Then, yeah, that, mm-hmm. you heard part of these proceedings by proxy, right?
Right. I was connected via Skype
yeah.
For at least the public portion of the meeting, and I did hear that elder speak, and that was just one aspect of the whole thing that did not inspire confidence, shall we say.
Yeah, and he went up to the line of saying that he made a mistake, or he shouldn't have done it, or he didn't want to have any part of it. He went up to that line, kind of danced around it, but he didn't cross the line and ultimately disavow what he participated in. But he did express regret at what happened and how it unfolded. So
yeah.
Then after that, there was very little in the way of instruction for the delegates or the congregation. I mean, the non-delegates who were present, as to what they could do or if they had an opportunity to speak. There was very little instruction. People didn't know what to do or how they were to act or what their role was if they came. Some of them came in the hope that if there was a discussion that they could say something on my behalf.
But yes, I remember.
There was very little. Yeah, what was that?
I said I remember that. People expecting that maybe there'd be an opening of the floor, but there was never any clarity on that. And of course, it didn't happen.
Yeah, there was no clarity, very little instruction. It seemed really vague. People didn't know what to do, what the protocol was, none of that. And so very early on, everybody was dismissed except the delegates, because they were going to go into executive session and discuss the Article 17 and how they were going to proceed. So I, as well as all of those who came to watch this who weren't delegates, were ushered out of the room and the doors were closed. And we waited in the fellowship room of this church right outside their sanctuary for the better part of 2 hours. I think it was in excess of 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can ask, what in the world would they talk about in 2 hours? What went on in that session? Because I was not going to contest the Article 17, and I had agreed to that, and people knew that before the meeting. So I wasn't contesting it. Therefore, the approval would have just been about the termination agreement and so forth. So we're not allowed to know what they talked about because they went into executive session.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very odd thing. Well after an hour had gone by, the clerk of classes who was the former clerk of classes, he wasn't the clerk at the time, but he was new to the classes. He was chairing the meeting. This was a pastor from one of the churches up there. He was chairing the meeting. And he came out and got me, like I say, well after an hour had gone by. And he comes and gets me in the fellowship room and wants me to go in and wants to know if I have any questions or if I want to make a statement.
And this had not been discussed or suggested previously.
No, not at all. So when you ask the question, what stands out to you, that is a very outstanding feature of the meeting. I was not apprised about what would happen. I was not told that I would have an opportunity to speak. I wasn't informed what the protocol or the procedures were at meetings like this. And I suppose you could say, well, why didn't you ask? But it was also communicated to me indirectly that I should keep my mouth shut and just do what I'm told in the days leading up to this. So mm-hmm. I wasn't in a position to make demands or make any waves or anything. But to my way of thinking, if there was a protocol or there were procedures, and if I was going to have an opportunity to address the delegates, they should have told me that. So
yes.
I was taken by surprise. I was caught off guard.
Mm-hmm.
And so then I have to, as I'm walking in there, as I'm walking up to the front of the sanctuary to address the delegates, I have to think in those few steps walking in what I'm going to say. And so all I did was I said, I don't really have anything to add to my statement. I had written a very lengthy response to the Article 17, and I expressed my concerns about the process and what happened. And I urged them to read that, to think about it seriously. And I also told them that I meant what I said when I said that there were charges made against me that weren't true.
Mm-hmm.
And I urged them to look into what happened. Please look into what happened. Assess what was said about me and understand that this was a bad process. and I wasn't going to fight it. One of the synodical deputies asked me if I wanted to fight this or something to the effect if I wanted to remain there or keep my job. And I said, no, it's all kind of late for that. You know, that's not what I want. I just want the truth to be known, and I want the record straight. I want the record to be accurate, the record of what happened. And things that were said about me and reports that were made were very clearly not. So not long after that, I was ushered back out, and then another good deal of time went by, and then they came and got us. And by that time, it was about 20 minutes to 10. So a meeting that started at 7 went past 9:30. And so they came and got us, and they informed us that the decision to separate, to have me separate from the congregation, was approved, and they approved the termination agreement. And when I went back in, they told me that I was going to have an oversight committee. And so probably that's the last most outstanding thing about that night, that meeting, was that they had selected three men to comprise an oversight committee, which would ostensibly guide me in the months ahead until I was declared ready to take a call and move on and pastor a church again or something. And that's all in the church order as well. But sometime between the close of the meeting or the close of the discussion and bringing us back in, they selected this oversight committee. So they said, this guy's got to have an oversight committee of three people. Who wants to do it? And so three people put their hands up. And so I got to meet them that night. You know, a couple of them I already knew because they were pastors in that classes. But, you know, the problem with what they did and how they handled it is there was no discussion or assessment of who would be good at that job, what the job entails. There probably wasn't even really a discussion then of the job description of what these guys would have to do, what their responsibilities would be. So they just did it on the fly without any reflection, without any prayer, without any consideration of who might be good at that. And so that had consequences down the road because those men and that committee did not serve me well at all as the process unfolded. So
right. Well, those were more procedural issues, I suppose, not really discussing what the job would be and therefore who would be suited to take it on and support and oversee you. But of course, then whoever it was going to be, without a proper investigation or a straightening of the record with which to work from before they set you off on the next stage, they were operating from false assumptions and premises anyway, which I guess we'll probably talk about those later, or how the oversight committee operated because of the false foundation that was put down before the special meeting. But when you've got both of those things, people who aren't suited to the role, then operating on the wrong assumptions set out for them in the documentation for that meeting, you get a disaster.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, one of the words you could use to describe it is contaminated. Mm-hmm. They were contaminated by a document that was written about me, a very significant document that was written about me by one of the church visitors. They were contaminated by that, as well as the proceedings that night during the Article 17.
Right.
Like I said, who knows what was said during those 2 hours? I was not allowed to face my accusers. And I do know one of the elders from my former church told me that some derogatory things were said, some allegations were made. But, you know, that's one of the fundamentals of American jurisprudence and even biblical law, is that you get to face your accusers. So there were things that were said about me. I don't know who said them. I don't know what was said. I never had an opportunity to respond. But those guys on that committee heard it all. So, so they were prejudiced against me because of that, because of this document that was written. And also, as a therapist, I had, after all of this went down, I saw a guy who has a counseling practice up in that area where I pastored. And he's also a retired minister. And he asked the question several times. He asked it of the classes, and he asked it rhetorically. He said, how can the entity which fired you now be responsible for your reinstatement. It's a conflict of interest. These are people who agreed that you should be gone and should be fired. And so now we're going to do an about face a few months later, and they're going to say, you're okay, we'll fire you. Well, his contention was that it should have been outsourced. And I agree with that. It should be handled by people who are objective and who haven't been involved in all of the mass machinations and what went down. Yeah, one more thing about the three guys that were selected to be on this oversight committee. We talked about giftedness, qualifications, even age. One of the guys that was on the committee was a new pastor, somebody half my age, you know, young enough to be my son, and hadn't had a lot of experience, so now he's going to be on my committee. But then you add to that other things like people who live in the community. One of the men who was selected attends the church, which is 3 miles away from where I pastored, and knows a number of the people which I pastored. So there's all of that kind of information and gossip that was available to him because mm-hmm. he lives in the community and is close to the people, and even some of the people in my church who didn't like me.
Right.
And so that is a clear problem. I mean, mm-hmm. I don't know how an objective person could look at that and not see a conflict of interest or see that there's going to be a problem with this guy's objectivity just from the fact that he lives in the community, has attended that church his whole life, and is also very familiar with the people who attended the church 3 miles up the road.
Mm-hmm. It's further contamination.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So if I had had anything to say about it, and if, you know, we were thinking about this, if we had decided to select this committee, say, a few weeks after the meeting rather than the night of, if we had time to think about it clearly, those are the kind of considerations that would have come up in a discussion of intelligently selecting a committee that would do this, right?
Yeah. You'd want experienced men who, well, it would have been nice if they could read, but experienced men who had nothing whatsoever to do with the local community.
Yeah, yeah.
At the very least.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
But I suppose that topic of the committee is a good point from which to segue into the next question, which is about Keith Manis, who wrote all the documentation for Aetna from the Article 17 to the bombshell document for the delegates' special meeting of classes. And I believe he also wrote the council's letter to the congregation in December of that year. Anyway, his hand was in quite a few of the pies that year, and those who've read the blog will have read all the documentation that he wrote or contributed to, and my back and forth with him. Maybe some wouldn't have known that almost 2 years ago, was it, or was it just over a year ago, you tried to talk to him?
Yeah, in March of 2017, 2 years,
yeah,
just a couple of months.
And those 2 years have gone by pretty quickly,
mm-hmm.
but there was that gap in between. You didn't really have much interaction with him between December 2015 and March of 2017. I just wanted you to describe for everyone, if you can, how the conversation with Keith Manis went and whether and how it still affects you.
Yeah. As you were describing our last interactions or connections at the time of my dismissal on Article 17, we had almost no interaction. I don't know if I had any communication with him from that December meeting. And then when I reconnected with him in March of 2017, I don't know if there was anything, but it had been on my mind. It had been bothering me for some time that there were people in the class of fellow ministers with whom there was a breach in the relationship. And so the thought that we were at odds with each other, that things weren't right, really bothered me. And as I actually described this to more than one person, but I said the thought that it's bad enough that Christians don't follow through on reconciliation or making things right when we know there are problems, but these are actually fellow ministers who were in the same class. So that bothered me. And I heard that he had taken a call to a church not far from where I relocated. So I relocated to another part of the state, which is a couple hours away from where I was before, and he did as well. And so he's pastoring, I think his church is about 40 minutes from where I live now.
Oh, it's very
and
close.
So, yeah, so it was on my mind to perhaps try to meet with him and see if we could get some sort of resolution to this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to his church on a Sunday morning in March. I just had felt inclined to do that for several days, and I wasn't exactly sure what I was going to do, but we met at the end of the service. He saw that I was there, and at the end of the service, we connected, and after he greeted people and most of the people had left, the sanctuary was almost empty. So we talked a bit, and I told him that the reason I came was I wanted to see if we could set up a meeting. I did not want to meet with him then. I told him that, but I said I would appreciate it if he would think about, in the next week or so, think about the possibility of us meeting, getting together to try to talk about what happened, because I knew things weren't right between us, and I assumed that he probably felt the same way. And yeah. As professing Christians and as ministers, it seemed like we should at least try to make things right. And I think I said to him at least once, but maybe more than once, that I didn't want him to give me an answer there. I didn't want to talk about it then. I just wanted to put the invitation out and have him think about it. Well, he didn't want to do that. He didn't even want to humor me on that score. He said that he was unwilling to do that, that it wouldn't do any good, and that that would only make things worse, and he wouldn't change his mind about what he did. He made the decisions that he made based on the information that he had, and that he wouldn't do anything differently. And so that was surprising. I mean, I was taken aback by that and felt kind of uncomfortable. And I actually, when I got home, I wrote down a number of things that he said.
Mm-hmm.
So I jotted down several quotes that were almost verbatim. And he said something to the effect that we won't get anywhere. I won't change my position and you won't change yours. And I know enough based on what I heard from the council and what I observed. And if we talked about it, you would only be more devastated at what I had to say. So, you know, those are all things that really should have been talked about, because as he said, he based his decisions on what he heard. And I understand that. However, if you made a wrong decision, and if what you heard was inaccurate or even a lie, then that's consequential to where we are in the relationship now. And then one of the worst things he said was, I don't have the kingdom energy to devote to this, which was a really not only odd, but, you know, I thought inappropriate thing to say in light of what the scripture says about reconciliation and making things right. You know, like Matthew 5 and Matthew 18. So yeah, I was very, very bothered by his attitude and by his unwillingness to at least meet and at least try to get some things on the table to talk about it and hopefully work towards reconciliation. I mean, I think we all realize, if we've been around on this planet for a while, we all realize that there are times where you talk about it and you hash it out and you meet and you even get other people involved and you do all of that and you still can't come to an agreement. I get that. You get that. Probably a lot of us get that. But if you don't even try, to me, what can I say? It seems like what? A cop out?
Well, yeah. And it's as if he considers what he documented, what he claimed, what he did on behalf of the council, and then your counter arguments and your documentation was sufficient or somehow already constituted an interaction that proved that neither of you were going to change or convince the other. But that's not really the case, because neither of you actually were together given the opportunity to interact with each other on these different things. There was no cross-examination or give and take.
Right.
So there hadn't been a discussion, and neither of you had an opportunity in the presence of the other to answer allegations or claims or arguments or anything like that. So he didn't have anything on which to base this claim that you wouldn't get anywhere, that anything that could be said had already been said. Yeah, it bothers me too, that Kingdom Energy remark, because he took the counsel so seriously, or at least was willing to go along from, I think, the very beginning with whatever they wanted to do, because it was so serious and so urgent.
Right.
But then after the fact, when it's just you and you're requiring in some measure both collegiality, Christian collegiality, and it could be seen as an aspect of pastoral care, well, now it's not really all that important. I threw all my weight and energy into this at the time, but now when somebody's really asking me for some investment, you know, now it's old stuff and I've got more important things to do now.
Right. Yeah, we can guess and we can speculate as to why he was unwilling to do it beyond just his statement, well, I don't have the Kingdom Energy for this. Now, we can also blow holes in that, because some things you don't have a choice. You don't have a right as a Christian to say, well, I'm not going to devote any Kingdom Energy into that when God tells you to do it, especially when a brother comes to you, tells you things aren't right, and I'm willing to meet with you and discuss this and try to bring this forward in some way.
Mm-hmm.
You really don't have a right to say, no, I'm not going to do that. But yeah, we can speculate, we can conjecture as to what's really going on here. And while certainly we don't know the intents and the motives of his heart, as the cliche goes, only God can judge that, I suspect that he doesn't want to hear, or he doesn't want to face, that he was precipitous and that he blew it.
Right.
He doesn't want to hear that the decisions that he made, which, as he said, it was based on the information I had, right? We get that. But you don't want to hear, Keith, that your information was bad and here's why.
Well,
boom, boom, boom.
And the problem was, he didn't just act as their notary to approve of everything. He acted as their agent and representative,
right,
and even crafted, mixing my metaphors, he crafted their weaponry, crafted their,
yeah,
their declarations, and then also shouted the charge or ordered the salvo, however you want to put it, even though the council's name was on all the paperwork. He wrote it. So he didn't just approve based on the information. He acted in their behalf.
Right.
And that's
right. He didn't just sign off on it, which a person could be held culpable. A person in his position, like a church visitor, could be held culpable for not getting into it, not really trying to hear both parties, and just signing off on it because you don't want to get that invested, or you don't want to take sides. So you just agree with it. Okay. Well, that would be irresponsible, but he didn't just sign off on it. He was actually kind of invested in it,
mm-hmm,
and took sides. And,
yeah,
and not only that, but he was sternly warned and reprimanded by another knowledgeable person in the church about what he was doing and why he was off track.
Mm-hmm.
And he ignored that person. And we,
yeah,
both know who I'm talking about, a,
mm-hmm,
man with legal training who also happened to be a judge in the county up there.
Yeah.
So he didn't just sign off on it. He was a partisan. He,
mm-hmm,
acted on their behalf. He didn't listen to me, and he didn't listen to this judge who told him that he had gone off track.
Yeah.
Yeah, so for those reasons, he's culpable. And for him to say, well, I did what I did, and you're not going to change my mind. Well, you can't say that, Keith, because you never really heard the other side of the story.
Mm-hmm.
And it wouldn't just be me. I mean, I could pull in this judge and other people who could refute accusations or allegations that were made against me.
Mm-hmm.
And then what would you say?
Well, but then we'd get to that worldview problem that started,
yeah,
started to rise above the surface in some of my interactions with him. Well, the refutation doesn't count because this was how people felt. And perception is enough, even if objectively what people claim are misrepresentations of reality.
Well, you can work towards the separation of a pastor and a church. You can work towards that predicated on how people feel. You can do that.
Yeah.
But it doesn't seem right or just to me to fire somebody and to besmirch someone's reputation based on a feeling.
Right. Well, I don't know if he would.
That's what happened. I mean, not only was I terminated, but my reputation was besmirched. And statements that were supposedly statements of fact were made about me that were derogatory and injurious to my character. So that's where the thing of the feelings and the worldview really breaks down. Doesn't cut it.
Well, I think at the stage of the Article 17, he perhaps wasn't thinking deeply or clearly or prayerfully enough when he wrote that document to realize just how damaging and libelous it potentially was if he was wrong. And of course, by the time we get to the special meeting of classes, he was really angry. So I'm not sure he would have cared then if what he was saying was damaging. But I think it was embarrassing to him after the Article 17 was rebutted by you and by the judge. I think he was embarrassed that it was as bad as it was, because I think at the time he was a bit loosey-goosey with it, because I think he thinks quite highly of his writing ability, but he whipped it up, or whipped it off, rather, and not only was it full of errors, but it was potentially libelous and very damaging to your reputation, and I think he wasn't thinking seriously enough about that or in your interest to avoid it.
Yeah, that's a real mouthful, what you just said. There's a few things at play. One of them is that when he originally drafted it, he did it on the pretext that he was this great wordsmith.
Mm-hmm.
Number 13, I'm sure it was number 13 who talked him into doing it, and the word wordsmith was used at the time. One of
yes.
the elders told me that
yeah.
they told him, they encouraged him to do it. Oh, please write this for us because you're such a great wordsmith. So he was flattered about it going in, and I'm sure that they told him how great it was when he finished it.
Mm-hmm.
But then you've got me picking it apart, and I was very, to put it bluntly, I was caustic. I was a bit sarcastic at points when I went through his Article 17, and I refuted it, and I picked apart some of the phraseology and so forth. And, of course, I wasn't supposed to know who wrote it then either. I was confronting the council on what they said.
Mm-hmm.
So I wasn't supposed to know that he had written it. But then the judge, he also wrote a 4 or 5 page rebuttal of what Keith Manus wrote. And he knew that Keith had written it. He was sure of it because he knew the writing styles of the men on the council. So he even told those guys, I know you guys wrote this. I know you church visitors wrote it.
Right.
And so knowing that, he was also very sarcastic and very caustic in his refutation and in exposing the word choices. And at one point, one of the things that Keith wrote was a bunch of gobbledygook, and the judge called it a word salad and belittled it. So I'm sure that was hard on the old ego, too. And Keith had a lot of ego invested in his decision to throw in with the council.
Mm-hmm.
And in his assessment of what happened and agreeing with them to do what they did, well, now his ego's invested, and so he's going to have to swallow a lot of pride to say, you know, maybe I really didn't know. Maybe I really wasn't that informed.
Yeah.
Yeah, so at the time, you know, when I saw him, and our meeting probably lasted about 15 minutes, but he came across, especially in the second half of our meeting, he came across as angry and sort of dictatorial. He said things like, I'm not going to deal with these issues. I'm not going to do this. We're not going to meet. It ends here. That's an exact quote.
It ends here.
Yep. I'm not going any further. This is the end of the discussion. You need to leave now. And that was said with some intensity. You need to leave now. And so I'm sure I looked puzzled, and I said something, you know, that I was surprised at that, or, you know, something like what do you mean, or why are we going this? And then he just said, you need to leave. So like I said, it lasted probably 15 minutes, not much longer than that, if any. And I left that building. I walked out of that church building, to my car, and I was very sad. I was very disillusioned. You know, this is what it is. Not only professing believers, but ordained ministers, the same denomination and the same classes. And is this where we are? To me, it's very sad. It's still very sad.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Very disillusioning. And then, you know, as you drive home and you think about it later, you think this is why people are disillusioned with the church. This is why people get cynical. This is why people walk away.
Cynical and maybe also a bit bemused because people behave this way and still have their jobs. And other people at every turn are trying to do the right thing and try to have a sense of humor and grace about even these very difficult interpersonal situations, and they don't have their jobs. Mm-hmm. They get driven out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, here are the leaders of the church, the leaders, the ordained ministers, and we tell everybody else what they need to do.
Mm-hmm.
We tell you people, you in the pew, we tell you what you're supposed to do and how you're supposed to live, and this is what the Bible says, and thus saith the Lord. And yet we can't get together, sit down at a meeting for an hour, 2 hours, and really kick this around and try to get to the bottom of it. Nah, we're not going to do that. You know, just forget about it. Uh-huh. We're not going to discuss that. I'm not going to discuss that with you. So that's where we are.
Yep, so you've had to hang up that phone, at least, the one to Keith Manis. What about Aetna, then? So it's been a little over 3 years. I often think about the congregational meeting, the one that took place after your Article 17, but before the classes meeting. I think it was mid-November 2015, and 13 led it, and he talked a lot. I think the opening of the meeting, he talked for, I think, 12 or 13, maybe 14 minutes straight. And he used the term journey countless number of times. Aetna's been on this journey the past 3 years. Where is Aetna now? And, well, maybe we can say, too, where has she been the last year or two?
Yeah, it's interesting you make reference to that congregational meeting. I'm fairly familiar with it because the meeting was recorded. I asked the sound men who I'm still on good terms with,
mm-hmm.
or should I say with whom I am still on good terms, let me be grammatically correct.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had them record the meeting, which they did. And so I got a copy of it and I recorded it. And so I've listened to it more than once. It's been a while, but I've listened to it more than once, and I'm very aware that number 13 had this, it was supposed to be an opening devotion, but he wound up giving a speech about journeys and all of that stuff for, like you say, 12 or 13 minutes. But yeah, where are they at now after 3 years? I recently talked to a young lady who no longer attends regularly, but she lives in the area and she visits the church from time to time. She was a regular the whole time I was there.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, she was a young person and is now in her mid-20s. But she told me that the church finally has a pastor who's going to serve them on an interim basis.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been over 3 years. I was terminated in November of 2015, and so they've been without a pastor for over 3 years. The new guy came, I think, just in the last couple of weeks. But how did the process unfold? Well, over a year and a half ago, they decided to share a pastor with an RCA church located several miles from Aetna, a church that's even smaller than they are and can't afford a full-time pastor. So I found out in the summer of 2017 that they had made the decision to call and share a pastor with an RCA church. And so they advertised this on the church network, on the denominations they call church network.
Mm-hmm.
And this past summer, after months and months, I think they might have gotten a couple nibbles, but not much activity. But this past summer, the stated clerk of my former classes, he expressed interest in taking a call to serve those two congregations. Now, the stated clerk is the guy we mentioned a few minutes ago who chaired that classes meeting. he pastored a church up north in the Classis, and eventually, some months after he came up there, he became the clerk, the stated clerk of Classis. The church that he pastored was actually also a small church, and it was on life support. I mean, they were not able to support a pastor, so the Classis really underwrote his salary. So the Classis supported them to the tune of about $30,000, but he had to get out just a few weeks ago because the funding was done at the end of 2018. So through this past spring and summer of 2018, you could say the handwriting was on the wall because the church hadn't turned around, and the funding was running out, and they weren't going to be able to afford to pay him. So he made overtures to Aetna Church and to this RCA Church. And the bizarre thing about it is that this guy is on my oversight committee. He's providing oversight for me in the aftermath of the Article 17. And while he's doing that, at the same time, he's talking to Aetna's counsel about their past and their situation and why are they vacant. And then while he's talking to their counsel about what happened and about me, he's also providing input to a committee about my future. So, you know, more than one person has had raised eyebrows and really reacted to say, wasn't this a conflict of interest? Why was he making overtures to them while he's overseeing you and your situation before you take another call? And I say, bingo, yeah, it's a conflict of interest. So I guess it actually went pretty far. He went and preached there, and they had a potluck, a dinner for him, you know, the whole nine yards to get to know him. Mm-hmm. And I also heard that in his message, he assured them that he would restore the joy to their church. And so you ask, how is Aetna doing? I found it interesting that he would be privy to that information.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it, that joy doesn't happen to be their, natural or default state? I thought the joy was supposed to come flooding back once you were gone.
Yeah, you know, and I raised that point. You know, I mentioned that in our conversation here because that was one of the bugaboos that they had with me, is that there were people who wanted more upbeat messages, and they wanted to hear joy, and they wanted me to pass out joy burgers, and that was missing. Mm-hmm. And the problem, of course, was me. The reason why there was a lack of joy was because I was so gloom and doom, and I wouldn't do what they told me to do.
Right.
But it is interesting that he said that he would make that assurance to them from the pulpit, that he would restore the joy to their church. So that tells me that he was talking to them about the situation and what the problems had been, which under ordinary circumstances, I don't know what you'd say about it, but certainly the fact that he was part of an oversight committee, I find it untoward. I find it inappropriate that he right. could be involved in that situation while he's still trying to deal with me. So.
Right. Well, he's still got some influence or some kind of authority over what happens to you. Ostensibly, he's supposed to be supporting you, but at the same time, he's courting for his livelihood the people who fired you and wrote up quite a bad report of you to boot.
Yeah, so it's like you can't see that this puts him in a compromising position. You know, who's he going to believe? The council that still has issues with me, which is a whole other story, or people there that had their beef? Who's he going to believe, them or me?
Well, he could find himself in a more amoral position, rather, where belief or what really happened doesn't matter. He's going to do what's expedient for him. If the people on the council or the people at Aetna who still hold something against you are wanting him to come, they'll want to hear that he's continuing to help put you in your place. So it won't really matter what he believes. It's more what he can do to get in the good books of the people who can call him and give him a more stable position.
Sure, I think that's a valid inference. Yeah.
I mean, it's only possible. Maybe he does actually believe them. You don't know. It's not necessary that he believe them to act contrary to your interest because he's looking out for his own.
Yeah, and how do you remain neutral in a situation like that? I mean, you can say, well, it takes two to tango, and there's always two sides to every issue or two sides to every story. But
Everyone knows that the objective, professional, appropriate thing to do is recuse yourself from at least one of those two things. And what does it matter to him whether he has any involvement in what goes on with you anyway? Surely let him go off and court Etna and let you alone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So one wonders, you know, how these people think if that crossed his mind. Funny thing is, when I mentioned this to the regional pastor, who's also functioning as my oversight committee along with this guy,
mm-hmm.
when I mentioned it to him, he didn't see a conflict of interest either. But when I mention it to other office bearers in other churches, they all have this uniform reaction, like he shouldn't have been doing that.
Well, I think the people who've been involved in this and had their feet stuck in the mire of it for so long can't think properly about it anymore. The regional pastor, as far as I gathered from your conversation with him, it mm-hmm. sounded like he thought you were objecting to it because you still wanted to go back to Etna, which is absurd. It's absurd.
Uh-huh.
The conflict mm-hmm. of interest exists apart from whatever it is you want to do with them or not anymore.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that he couldn't even understand what the issue was, and that you wanting to still pastor Etna is something that was dead 3 years ago and established 3 years ago, that it was too late. And how could you possibly think of going back now after all the water under the bridge? So it was just, absurd and quite surprising that that was his response.
Mm-hmm.
I think people's minds and spirits are affected by having been caught up or immersed in this for so long.
But it, not to be too repetitious, and I suppose you can edit this out if you want to, but this will be repetitious, but it's very striking that the uniform lack of getting it on the part of the people from up there who are on the oversight committee. And of course, I don't know if this crossed this guy's mind or not, that he shouldn't be doing this, or it's a little awkward for the regional pastor to totally not get it.
Yeah.
And yet, right on the other hand, this marked contrast with every single office bearer, pastor, elder that I've mentioned about this, and they all go, that's a conflict of interest. Can he do that? What's going on? Everybody has a reaction but them.
Yeah, they don't see it. They can't hear it. It is bizarre.
It's all just more intrigue, more weird, odd Twilight Zone stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Well, as it turns out, it seems he took a call just a couple months ago to a church in Iowa, mm-hmm. and of course that left Etna vacant. And I don't know if they were aware that this pastor was looking at other churches. I'm not sure if they knew that or not.
Hmm.
But if they didn't know, then of course they were kind of left high and dry when he decided to leave where he was up north and then head out to Iowa. But anyway, the new guy has been called to serve on an interim basis. So this will be just, I don't know, 4 months, 6 months, something like that. And he's retired. And I happen to know who he is. I haven't met him in person, but I preached one of the last services at his church in Wyoming, which is about a half hour from here.
Mm-hmm.
And this was in the spring of 2017. So the church where he pastored for a number of years had been struggling toward the end. And so they closed in the spring of 2017. And I think the second to the last service is the one that I preached. So
interesting.
Yeah. And so I guess that's all they'll be able to do for a while because they can't afford to call a non-retired full-time pastor. Hence, that's why.
Oh, they were still sharing, wanting to share with the other neighborhood church.
Yeah, because that plan has been in the offing, like I said, for a year and a half. So I got the impression in talking to this young lady and also from some other feelers, maybe several months ago, I get the impression that not having a pastor has gotten old. So, you know, there's no consistency from week to week. You've got a short list of retired pastors and whoever can come in and preach on a given Sunday, but, you know, they rotate in and out. I think at one time there were half a dozen or so, but, you know, there's no consistency week to week. And so I'm sure that's gotten old for a lot of them. And I also heard that the bulletin secretary sometimes has to plan, or maybe I should say frequently, but she has to plan a lot of the worship orders because the guest pastors don't do it.
Well, it's not their job, is it?
Right. Maybe to kick a song in or an idea for a hymn or two. But see, I used to do all of that. I used to plan those services and come up with not only liturgy, you know, the basic liturgy, but responsive readings and a number of things to make it so that it's not the same week after week after week. So now they've had 3 years where they've had to do that on their own, and I'm sure that they have discovered, whoever's done it, I'm sure has discovered that it doesn't just happen. So,
right. Well, and it's a lot easier to do it if you are a pastor or if you're someone who's on church staff, because you see everything from that perspective, and you've had training and experience to do it. So while it takes time, you do know what you're doing, and you know, week by week, you have in your mind what you've been preaching and what things should look like, how they should fit together. And also, because it is your job, your mind is much more there,
mm-hmm.
you know, rather than having to shift between your job and this task you do once a week. Yeah, it's probably a lot more effort for them to do it than it would be for a full-time pastor who's seeing the big picture all the time. Yeah, I can't imagine. I do wonder what it's been like for them to have it. To me, it seems quite clear, and I plan to write to the council soon. I think I'm going to have them send my membership papers just over here. We don't have a CRC church for them to forward to, but I'll talk to them. But I think I may say quite pointedly, it doesn't seem that God has, it doesn't seem obvious that God blessed their decision in 2015.
Yeah, if he has, I would be interested in hearing the details,
mm-hmm.
yeah, mm-hmm, of how he did that, mm-hmm. or in what ways this blessing was experienced, other than people who didn't like me are glad that I'm gone.
Yeah, that's a bit too subjective, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And a bit too individualistic. Yeah.
Yeah, I can say a couple more things about where Aetna's at. I had heard that. I mean, as we close, if you can squeeze in just a couple more minutes, but
yeah, it's fine.
I also heard that that lightning struck the bell tower. She said that, and that this affected the power supply in the front of the building, and it also damaged the projector, so they can't do any of the stuff on the screen. So the projector needs to be replaced. And as far as the leadership is concerned, you know, when you ask how are things going at Aetna 3 years later, as far as the leadership is concerned, they really still haven't come to grips with how they treated me, what happened, the impact that it had on me. I had some interaction with the council in early September,
mm-hmm.
and the little bit that they wrote in a couple of emails spoke volumes.
Yes.
So that, I believe that is on your blog, but I guess in the end, the council got what they wanted 3 years ago, not the church, because most of the people weren't aware, didn't know what was going on or what they were doing. But the people, the few people who did this got what they wanted. And the question is, now where are they? They're 3 years down the road. They finally got somebody to step in on an interim basis. But if they had worked with me to leave on good terms and seek another call, they probably wouldn't be in this position. So,
well, certainly, I'm willing to bet that the morale would be better, and at least the majority of folk could have clear consciences. I'm not sure how many of them are bothered by what happened, but it was wrong. And if they'd gone about it in a better way, that at least would be working in their favor going forward.
Well, some of them are clearly bothered by it. Some of them know things aren't right. And the reason I know that is because I've had no communication from them.
That's...
And they were people with whom I communicated, interacted with, fellowshipped with, and was on good terms with.
Right.
Until it all happened.
They let it get ugly.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And so now, you know, here are the consequences. And And boy, believe me, when I heard that lightning had struck the bell tower, I couldn't help but think, you know, is someone trying to tell them something? But I guess we can't conclude too much from that. It's not quite the same as the tornado that blew down the steeple of that ELCA church the day after they declared homosexuality as an okay thing. You remember that?
I don't, but yeah, it sounds like quite clear messaging. But lightning striking the tower is also some interesting imagery. I'll have to think about that.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And the fact that it affected their technology.
Yep. So, yeah, I guess that's it. That's a real brief overview of where they're at, as far as I can tell, 3 years down the road. But like I said, a big insight comes from those two communications that I got from the council in September. Those really brief emails that I got. There's a lot there. There's a lot to read between the lines, even.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of what they wrote and how little it was. And then, of course, the last thing was, if you have any questions, any further questions, don't talk to us. Don't write to us. Talk to the clerk of classes, or, you know, talk to the interim committee, or however they put it. But, yeah.
Yeah. Another real inspiration of confidence.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Some fear, some anxiety, a lack of conviction. And then, of course, they're not really able to answer questions straightforwardly, and they're quite evasive and tend to obfuscate.
But when they say, don't write to us, we don't want to hear from you, you know, go away.
Yeah.
When they say that after you pastored them for 8 years, that tells you, we know things aren't right.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So now what are we going to do about it?
Just keep pushing it away.
Yeah, just let it lie, you know. I laugh. It's very sad, but yeah, you know, you shouldn't be doing that. You know things aren't right, so you should try to bring about some sort of reconciliation.
You know you're sick, but you won't take your medicine.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
What a shame. Well, I think that's a good place to leave it for now, because next time we can move on to some bigger picture classes kind of stuff. Talk about the larger scale or longer term procedural and personnel issues of the last several months.
Yeah, that would be the meeting with the bureaucracy and the classes meeting.
Mm-hmm.
The takeaways, yeah.
Yeah. So we'll start with that for next time.
All right.
All right, so thanks to Simon. That wraps up our second installment of this interview series. Thank you all for listening. Join us next time for the third installment, where we'll be moving on to bigger classical organization and procedural type things, problems at the higher levels. And we'll be talking to Simon about more recent history then. So tune in next time to Verivox. We'll see you all then. In the meantime, God bless, and remember our motto, Usque Fasque.